thought we'd do some review, and I was just trying to figure out how long it's going to take to do this. I lied. We probably won't get through it by summer, just so you know. Hopefully we can, say, do 10 pages a week. And that there are 140 pages left. Now, we might slow down, we might speed up. That'll be 14 weeks. And I think I didn't count the number of dates I put on that sheet, but probably about 8, I bet.
11.
11. Well, yeah. So I doubt whether
unless
we will.
Unless we don't make that Easter week.
Yeah, we can negotiate that. Mm-hmm. Just so you know.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with this class, but some people asked me after the talk last time about the book. So I thought I'd bring it along if you want to have a look. See.
Okay.
I don't know whether it's still in print or not, but that's the paperback with both the Jung and the Wilhelm essays in it.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one we had at Friends of Jung or not?
It's a different cover.
Okay. Did they have that at Friends of Jung?
We had The Secret of the Golden Cloud, but I don't know.
Was it the Jung Wilhelm combined edition?
Maybe not.
I don't think so. No. Whatever you told Carolyn, she bought.
I have no idea what I told her.
Anyway, we had, and we might have sold them all, because there were several people with them.
Well, that's probably what I did say, because I wouldn't know any other edition. It could be a different cover.
It's not the same cover. And I bought one at Prince Young and Son. We had one at home.
In the collected works, you have the Jung essay, but you don't have the Wilhelm essay, so you have to buy that paperback to get the Wilhelm essay. It's got the Jung essay with it.
Yeah, we'll buy that for you.
I think Marge wanted it, but let me ask her.
Marge, no, I don't want it.
Okay.
I already read your copy, and okay. No, nothing I want
for my library.
Saturday.
Review. And I also brought along some other information that I wanted to present last time and either forgot or didn't have. So I'll add a little bit to what we talked about last time. First thing we talked about was on page 256, the woman who brought death and put it to flight. How would I put it? The mixture of opposites of that Sophia, feminine. Both kills and brings rebirth. Very close to what the great mother did in pre-Christian religions. 256, the same passage, same idea, just a different set of words. The soul is taken away and given back. And that is that the soul is purified. So the taken away would be the death, given back would be the rebirth. And what's that about? Generally, it's about, in our day, power. Not using people. Not relating to people and using them. But relating to people to relate to people. The same idea, corruption of one is generation of the other on 256. All this idea that this is a death and rebirth through the feminine. Then von Franz talked about on 256 that what this image does, this image of a woman who... do you mind just closing that door? I get worried about what we say here. that woman who does both... is present in Christianity, but she's present as two separate figures, as Eve, who brought death, and Mary, who brought life. So it's not that it's foreign to Christianity, but it's split in Christianity. Then we talked about the image, so that was the end of that chapter. The next chapter, the main image was that that Sophia is in prison. We talked about that as the meaning of the experience being not available until you work on it. We have the experience but miss the meaning, in Eliot's phrase. So to extract the meaning is to release the anima, or release Sophia from prison. The other way to look at that is that it's an image of the rigidity of the ego that keeps the Sophia meaning embedded in a literalized interpretation of the experience. You're like, you have a desire and then you have to fulfill it. That's a rigidity versus being able to work with it. Another dimension we talked about, and what I wanted to just read you a little bit, was actually in dreams, the prison image is often very positive, because it comes about when the ego is coming into service to the self, and the ego initially experiences that service as an imprisonment. Over time, we try to reconcile to what is being asked of us, so it feels like an invitation, not a sentence. That's often quite a struggle. And I mentioned how a couple of political figures who had actually literally been imprisoned wrote about it in a positive way, and I wanted to read you the one quote I mentioned, Havel's Letters to Olga. Just a couple of passages, just to let you hear his thought about his imprisonment. And then I found another quote in the same book, which is so close to Sophia, I thought I'd read it to you as well, just as a little extra. This is Letters to Olga, page 300. All things considered, it seems increasingly clear that my prison term is merely a necessary and inevitable phase of my life. And in fact, it's a little surprising that it was so long in coming. I subconsciously did everything I could to ensure that the inevitable would finally happen. So the question is not whether it had to happen, but merely how I've come to terms with it and what I've made of it. My grand plans to write, study, work on myself, etc. in prison have proved immensely naive, of course. I had no idea what it would be like here. And so, of all of that, only one thing has remained. The chance to prove to myself, to those around me, and to God, that I am not a lightweight, as many have seen me, that I stand behind what I do, that I mean it seriously, and then I can take the consequences. To put it more simply, I had to act as I did. There was simply no other way. See, that's a great man speaking. But here's what he says just a couple of days before in another letter, which shows you how, of course, he wasn't using the word Sophia, but you'll hear the resonance to our themes in the way he's understanding his life. I'll start off a paragraph earlier. This is page 295. The world modern man creates is an image of his own condition, and in turn, it deepens that condition. It is a world that, as they say, has got out of hand. It is driven by forces that utterly betray particular responsibilities. At the same time, the stronger these forces are, the stronger their momentum becomes, and the harder they are to control, and thus the stronger the magnetic field dragging man deeper and deeper into his own helplessness, alienation, depersonalization, and ultimately, something that may represent the bottom itself, into a state of apathetic contentment with his condition. I didn't read that right. But the idea is that the problem is that you get used to it, you say. I skipped a little bit. Is there really nothing to be done? If I consider the problem as that which the world is turning me into, that is, as a tiny screw in a giant machine, deprived of human identity, then there is really nothing I can do. Obviously, I cannot put a stop to the destruction of the globe, the growing stupidity of nations, and the productions of thousands of new thermonuclear bombs. Here comes the Sophia line. If, however, I consider it as that which each of us originally is, if I consider it as that which each of us originally is, that's Sophia, or rather what each of us, irrespective of the state of the world, has the basic potential to become, which is to say an autonomous human being, capable of acting responsibly to and for the world, then of course there is a great deal I can do.
That's all.
No, he's not saying that each of us are Sophia, is he?
I think he's saying each of us is originally somebody.
Okay.
And if I look at the world, I say I can't change the world, then I fall into despair. But if I say I can become whom I've been given to be, mm-hmm. then there's hope.
Okay.
For my life and what I can contribute.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
when did he write? 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
They have.
They've gotten.
The same patterns have reemerged stronger than before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a fall of Berlin Wall and stuff. They thought, hey, no communism, no more need for thermonuclear devices.
He must be a character, too, I guess, when he was in New York against all protocol. This was some years ago. He was on an official visit. One night he called up Madeline Albright. He says, hey, Madeline, let's go listen to some jazz. So they went and drank scotch and listened to jazz all night. This was an official visit. That's the kind of guy he is. He's brilliant and goofy at the same time.
Down to earth.
Down to earth at the same time. The president of Czech Republic.
Okay.
H-A-V-E-R.
I got the spelling.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He was there, I think probably still is, their foremost playwright, and then got imprisoned under the communist administration.
Okay.
Several of his plays have been on the PBS, Masterpiece Theater. And then, after he got out of prison, he was elected president of the Czech Republic. Yeah, I think he still is. Every time I drink a Pilsner Urquell, I think, because that's he was imprisoned in Pilsen. It's where the word Pilsner comes from, that town. And that's where these letters were written from Pilsen.
And he was in prison because of his...
Crimes against the state by the communists.
Wasn't he a writer?
He was a playwright.
Which is interesting that a creative person could be considered threatening to the political apparatus of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But doesn't the creative people
mm-hmm. and they don't pay any attention.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's the best way to diffuse that, is just not to ignore them. But somebody like that, who's that creative, they couldn't be ignored because his work was so compelling.
Mm-hmm.
So the state had to respond.
You get a feeling in that book, just to mention it, if... You know, you think of cruelty as like Auschwitz, but he said things like, you know, they would come, this is before he got in prison, they would come, they'd slash his tires. And then he couldn't get the tires fixed in the town, because going to the supermarket and getting gasoline and every little detail was thwarted. And that's how they slowly drive you crazy, I guess. Not the gross torture, but every little detail of life becomes so... distasteful to you that you're supposed to give up, and he never gave up, which is amazing. And kept a sense of humor about it, apparently.
And aren't creative people supposed to sort of have something about the future in them that they can perceive or something, like artists? And
well, and yes, they pay a terrible price, and I think under that sort of pressure, a lot of people would just give up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But certainly you can see... in his work, it's an attempt to keep the spirit free, which then he turned into a political reality.
Mm-hmm.
And with this sense that he is to be somebody, and he didn't let the fact that the world was all screwed up demoralize him from becoming the person he was meant to be.
Yeah.
That's what I think is so beautiful, and why this material I think is so important, and ultimately socially relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, prison. Next image we talked about was on 262, and that was moving her candlestick out of its place. We talked about the candlestick as the understanding, the illumination that Sophia represents, and out of its place was the place put, it was put in by patriarchal Christianity. And what we have to do is restore it. We talked about the light of nature, 263, lumen naturale, another word for candlelight. Candlelight, light of nature, the sparks, scintillae, would be the Latin, all the same, for the luminosity of the archetype or the understanding which is in the symbol-creating function of the personality, which is there independent of the ego. Big, big assumption of Jung. You don't have to do it all. You just have to listen and then execute what you're given. 264, where the text talked about honey, we talked about the honey of understanding, which is that the soul or Sophia feels as nourishing your attention given to your dreams, your devoted attention to your dreams. That the soul or Sophia feels as nourishing the attention that the ego gives to the dreams, the devoted attention to the dreams. And I can't stress enough that word devoted. It's like, you know, if you wanted to even take it to its lowest level, think of the unconscious as a dog. You can't just play with your dog when you feel like it. You can't just feed your dog when you feel like it. You know, you have to feed it regularly or it becomes ill. And the same with the unconscious. Better to give it no intention than a half-assed attempt. Another image which we talked about, and we will again return to today, so I also want to read you a quote, which I actually forgot to read you last time. It appeared on 267 in the text, where she asks for clear water to be poured over her. And von Franz talked about the meaning of that on 267, washing the soul with wisdom and understanding. So that water stands for understanding, and the washing stands for covering yourself with understanding, covering your unconscious material with understanding, bathing it in understanding. And Edinger has a wonderful little about two paragraphs on that. This is from the Ion Lectures, page 123, the Ion Lectures. We'll pick up on this again, so I think it's worth hearing. The image in alchemy that she'll be referring to is the aqua doctrinae, A-Q-U-A, water, doctrinae, D-O-C-T-R-I-N-A-E, which means the water of doctrine. So what the symbolic new synapse we have to make up here is that water actually equals a way of thinking. And there's no way to really logically explain that except to show how the human symbolic mind has linked up water and doctrine. And the idea is, I think, that... I forget exactly how it is biblical. Those of you who know the Bible better than me can help here. That when Christ is pierced, water comes out, right? That is the water of doctrine. So, that was interpreted by the church fathers as the water of doctrine. So, it's a water, it's an understanding that has its source in the self, is how we would probably translate that. This is not just any water, it's the water from Christ. In the church's mind, and in our mind, it would be the water from the self. And I'll just read you what Jung says about it. This is Edinger now. Jung describes this aqua doctrinae in the psychology of the transference. He says, now he's quoting you. Here we seem to have a hint about the treatment required, because in the what Jung is doing is he's interpreting a set of alchemical pictures where the aqua doctrinae plays a role. Faced with the disorientation of the patient, the doctor must hold fast to his own orientation. That is, he must know what the patient's condition means. He must understand what is of value in the dreams, and do so moreover with the help of that aqua doctrinae, which alone is appropriate to the nature of the unconscious. Now, what that means is you have to know the mythological background for the confusing material that's appearing in people's dreams in a period of crisis, so you can see what otherwise would look pathological. You can see how that is in fact a meaningful attempt of the psyche to bring a new orientation to the person. And without the mythological background, and I would say, even here is where Christian is important. It's going to have Christian elements in it. It's going to have classical elements in it, and it's going to have alchemical elements in it. That's why Jung made such a careful study of all three cultures. So that's what the aqua doctrinae is. It's that the system of symbols which show that death is ultimately a stage before rebirth. And when you're in the death thing, you just think you're dead. In other words, Jung goes on, he must approach his task with views and ideas capable of grasping unconscious symbolism. See, thoughts don't grasp images. Other images grasp images. You have to have the bigger mythological image to understand the particular personal manifestation of that image. I'll give you an example of that as we go on today. Intellectual or supposedly scientific theories are not adequate to the nature of the unconscious. This is why I loathe psychology, because it's theory, and it cannot grasp the nature of our inner world.
Was that why psychology loathes Jung?
Probably. Yeah, because we can dissolve them, but they can't dissolve us. Intellectual or supposedly scientific theories are not adequate to the nature of the unconscious, because they make use of a terminology which has not the slightest affinity with its pregnant symbolism. The waters must be drawn together and held fast by the one water. So the waters would be the individual dream images that are appearing, and the one water would be the larger understanding of the mythological process of transformation, which puts into context the specific series of images you're dealing with.
What page is that?
This is all in Ion Lectures 123, and the quote is from volume 16, paragraph 478.
Would you just read that last?
Sure.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to back up another question,
too. In other words, he must approach his task with views and ideas capable of grasping unconscious symbolism. Intellectual or supposedly scientific theories are not adequate to the nature of the unconscious, because they make use of a terminology which has not the slightest affinity with its pregnant symbolism. The kind of approach that makes this possible must therefore be plastic and symbolical, and itself the outcome of personal experience with the unconscious content. You can't learn this in a classroom.
What were you saying about a smaller body of water and a larger body of water?
Let me see.
That was your amplification.
No, that
water
was...
Or the individual must be together and...
Help. Let me find that again. The waters must be drawn together and held fast by the one water. So the waters would be all your various images in your dreams, and the one water would be the knowledge of the myth
to the larger context.
The larger context.
It's a big transformation, I think.
Yeah, and what we're talking about here is that the myth is the various ways that the psyche has symbolically portrayed the process of transformation. Because, you know, as we've talked about, part of that transformation is destruction. And that's usually how people come into therapy, in a state of being destroyed, either a marriage or a work or a disease. And you look at the destruction and you think it's bad, but when you realize it's part of a larger series that's leading somewhere, then you can help them. And if you don't know that, you're lost. So the kind of approach that makes this possible, this meaning the combining of the waters by the one water, makes this possible, must therefore be plastic and symbolical, and itself the outcome of personal experience with unconscious contents. It should not stray too far in the direction of abstract intellectualism. Hence, we are best advised to remain within the framework of traditional mythology, which has already proved comprehensive enough for all practical purposes. This does not preclude the satisfaction of theoretical requirements, but these should be reserved for the private use of the doctor. That's Jung. Now, here, Edinger sums it up nicely, I think. He says, I think that is a very important passage because in my experience, we all tend to cling to abstract theoretical formulations because they are the easiest. They don't require wholeness of response, which is very difficult. I think that this also applies to interpretations which refer back to childhood experience. It is relatively easy to point out that a current life experience, a current manifestation of a complex, derives from its earlier version. We have a theory that enables us to understand that very well. While such interpretations are partially true, the trouble is they don't heal. They don't transform the original experience. They point it out that one is still stuck with the original experience. They satisfy the head, but the heart says, so what? What we need at such times is the aqua doctrinae, the relevant amplifying image that has the power to transform the complex or the original traumatic experience by enlarging the conscious attitude, by setting the original experience in a larger context that releases the ego from bondage to the original trauma. That is how I understand the aqua doctrinae. We'll come back to that water image today. It appears again. Then we got into the Carol raised a question, which I said I would do some homework on. On 265 and 266, she mentions the word anthropos. And the idea is, she says, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down, after the quote on 265, the goal is to produce the unitary man who is without stain. Carol said, what's that about? And then over on 266, the first sentence after the quote, she says, with these words, the author subtly reverts to the theme of the unitary man or anthropos. And I didn't know where that came from. Believe it or not, it comes from St. Paul. And this is what I found. I will post this on my website, or I'll post a link to this if you want to read it for your own information. But just to give you a quick summary. In 1 Corinthians 15:45, Paul refers to Jesus Christ as the last Adam. And the Greek is, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, ho eschatos Adam. Ho must be the. And interesting, last is eschatos. It's not exactly last. It's like eschatology. It's that same word. But it's translated as the last Adam. I think you could almost say this, eschatological Adam, the Adam at the final end of the story. So Paul refers to Jesus Christ as the ho eschatos Adam. In contrast to the first man Adam, which in the Greek is ho protos anthropos Adam, ho the, protos first, but first like in prototype. It's amazing what you lose in translation, isn't it? The prototypal Adam, ho protos anthropos Adam, it's stressed that that Adam is a man, a human animal. And the second Adam is, it doesn't say anthropos, it just says eschatos Adam. So that then led to this whole tradition, I guess, of looking at Adam as the first Adam and Christ as the second Adam, or Adam as the first anthropos and Christ as the second anthropos. And Adam would be the natural, unconscious, instinctual, natural creature, and Christ in the Christian sense would be the perfected human being. And of course the alchemists then take that up and they change perfected to whole. And then Jung takes it up to mean not perfected but conscious. That's where it comes from apparently from St. Paul. And then it goes through the Gnostics picked it up, certainly church fathers picked it up, and then alchemy picked it up. And the idea is that what Jung makes of that is that we are trying to recreate the whole human being that was present in the primeval human being. That's why this comes up, and why she says to produce the unitary man out of the first man. And that is so germane to our understanding of Sophia, because see, the Sophia experience comes out of that first anthropos. It's the desirousness, it's the power, it's the low form of the beginning, but not to be despised, because within the low form is hidden the meaning. And what we try to do is work with that meaning and bring it to consciousness, and in that sense create the second anthropos, which is without stain. The Christians would mean that meaning without guilt. We would understand that to mean, I think, without ulterior shadow motives.
Oh, so the one without stain was not the church's version, as opposed to the alchemical version, which was the...
Probably Vir Unus.
Unitary man.
Is the produced the unitary man, the Vir Unus. I don't know whether that's, I'm thinking that's alchemical. And they might say without stain, but then they would use that word stain differently than the church would use the word stain. But the idea is in the second one there's a purity, which isn't in the first. And each tradition interprets that differently.
Is it which?
In the first and the second there's a purity,
okay,
which is not in the first. And each tradition will interpret that differently. Christianity will treat that as without guilt. I think the alchemist would treat that without fragmentation, you know, because they think that that initial material is fragmented. Even they say that. They don't take that psychologically. And then what Jung would say is that the without stain is without unconsciousness. So the idea is there, but it's interpreted differently in three different traditions.
In other words, in consciousness, that is the whole.
Consciousness is getting rid of the stain. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sammy.
I've taken it to another level, and I don't know if it's right or not, but when you bring up Sophia then, and that is that second creating consciousness,
mm-hmm,
because of her... Because she is an embodiment,
mm-hmm,
would that not lead to not only consciousness but meaning?
Meaning, consciousness, meaning, and flesh.
Okay.
What The identity we are trying to create through the Sophia experience is both conscious and it lives meaningfully in history. And I think Havel is a classic example of that. And it is embodied here in time and space. You see, the Christian idea, the second anthropos, is that it leaves. But this idea of the anthropos is that it's right here. I think Jung would say that Sophia is a means whereby. It's the nature of a particular type of experience whose current goal is to bring into being the second anthropos. And for the moment, at least, what we have got is a better understanding of what the nature of that second anthropos is than either the Christians or the alchemists. The Christians took that second anthropos as meaning pure. The alchemists took it as external to them. And and Jungian psychology can now say we are trying to create a full human being. And it has certain aspects of what Christianity has described as full. It has certain aspects of what alchemy has described as full. And here are some other characteristics of it. Now, 200 years from now, they may look back and say, well, you know, there was the Christian interpretation, there was the alchemical interpretation, there was the Jungian interpretation, and now we have the final interpretation. But in a way, that's not so surprising because our idea of what we are capable of is growing.
Would Jung be interpreted as the second anthropos?
Well, I personally feel he did achieve what he was here to do. So by the end of his life, I would say he had fulfilled the incarnation of the self, which is the production of the anthropos. Yeah.
Okay.
And you see, the other thing, you know, about this is, and here I think the Christian symbolism is terribly relevant, that it is eternal. And by eternal, like I've said before, to me, at least it means lasting a long time. That when you do fulfill the purpose that you're here for, the effects that you create live on past your own death. It's eternal, at least in that way. There may be other ways that we don't or can't substantiate, but I think that one of the marks of the individuated person, if you will, is this ability to see things in a long-term view, in a long-term perspective. You don't just make decisions for immediate satisfaction. If Havel had made decisions based on immediate satisfaction, he would have figured that prison was a waste of his time. But he saw, no, it is part of my development.
Would you say that's true of Bonhoeffer and Mandela too?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Bonhoeffer got killed. But definitely, I think Bonhoeffer, Sadat, Mandela for sure. Definitely. So don't wish to be a prophet. You see what they have to go through. I don't know how, I mean, that these people, I think, are just of a different fiber. All of us, any of us, probably would have collapsed under that pressure.
But not if you were created to be that.
But, yeah, and somehow also had the strength to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that would have sort of been built into them then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I, you know, tragically, I think there are other people who are given this potential and they don't have the strength. Mm-hmm. And they end up in the psych wards.
Mm-hmm. Or commit suicide.
Or commit suicide, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or become a communist, you know.
One Mandela was in prison for 25 years.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and Bonhoeffer was out into the free world and went back into Germany.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He got out and said, well, how can I participate
in Germany's
reconstruction if I haven't gone through the pain with Germany? Mm-hmm. And if he didn't sneak back in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's another amazing human being. Read his letter. He's got a book, Two Letters from Prison. Mm-hmm. Sure, the same beautiful. And he really took on. We just live in this time where everybody's trying to get their own, you know, and it just makes me sick. And then you read what real great people have done. That he was like a golden boy, you know. He was like a Harvard Brahmin sort of guy. If you read the social milieu that have. Of his family's second relations, they were friends with the high German command, and that he volunteered to go back and take on the pain of the nation, not to just write cute little essays while being a theology professor somewhere. Yeah. They're inspiring.
Can I just ask one quick question? When I hear the word stain, my Catholic upbringing for your immediately what comes to mind is original sin.
Mm-hmm.
That we were taught that that's original mm-hmm. sin, and that Eve was the one that brought original sin to the world, but what she really brought into the world was consciousness,
mm-hmm.
that separation
mm-hmm.
from God. So would there be a connection between Eve and Sophia then? That,
mm-hmm.
that she's kind of that first?
Mm-hmm.
That's being,
she brings both.
She brings both.
Mm-hmm. First she messes you up, and then she mm-hmm. heals you. Yeah, you know, and the mythological precedent for that would be, I think we talked about it, would be Ra and Isis. Did we talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Where the Isis, the cow, puts a poison worm in the path of Ra, the sun, lames him, and then carries her on her back. But you know those pictures you might have seen of Isis with the circle in her horns? That's her carrying the wounded Ra. And she carries him then to heal him. So first she lames him and then she heals him. Okay. The last point we talked about, and I think if you agree, I'm going to also make a little detour here and give you an example, which I didn't have, but sure enough, a dream appeared in my practice this week, right out of this material. And I'm not going to go into the details of the dream. I'll just give you the main image to respect the dreamer. But the last point we talked about was 292. No, sorry, 267. And that was that the self crystallizes out as an independent content. We have the theme on page 266 in the quote, that there may dwell in me the virtue of penetration. So suddenly Sophia becomes masculine. She penetrates. So von Franz interprets that is out of this experience something new is crystallized, and I use the metaphor of adding a catalyst to a solution, and something precipitates out. Something just comes out of this experience. And I feel like I would present this to you in the form of a little pop quiz. See if you can work with this. You may not get it, but because it's an obscure reference. But if you don't, I'll read you the parallel, and then we can go from there. Again, I don't want to give you any specific details. I will say the dreamer is going through a difficult time. And the dream is quite involved. But the basic image is the dreamer finds a baby swaddled asleep in a tree. Now, I am saying that is an example of the self crystallizing out of the experience. Why do I say that? How would you interpret that image and give me the reasons for saying that?
Well, that's an image from the Grail legend. The babe in the tree.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Which isn't handled in the right way, so it's as though the babe that will be born goes unconscious.
That's one parable.
Sure, I'll have to check that. I wasn't aware of that. Or I've forgotten it, one or the other.
I'm pretty sure I can look it up, but...
Yeah, do. I'll check it, too. It's probably, is it Emma Young's? Okay. I was going with a different amplification. But it might be the same. I'm just not aware of that context. Anyone know?
Are you suggesting there's a myth?
Big red flag there, if you know your alchemy. Yeah, I'm not saying you should know it. It's obscure. As alchemical symbols, it's obscure. So let me read you the fairy tale, which I think is the background for the dream. And then I'll read you Jung's commentary to the fairy tale, and you'll see how close it is to the Sophia. So I'm trying to give you another example of how this stuff actually looks in practice. This is the fairy tale. It's from his essay, The Spirit of the Curious. It's in volume 13, and it's on page 193. In the fairy tale, it's a Grimm's, and it's called The Spirit in the Bottle. Okay, Healy, I'm surprised you didn't pick this up.
Well, I'm too.
But you're forgiven. Once upon a time, there was a poor woodcutter. He had an only son whom he wished to send to a high school. However, since he could give him only a little money to take with him, it was used up long before the time for the examinations. So the son went home and helped his father with the work in the forest. Once during the old midday rest, he roamed the woods and came into an immense old oak. See, we got a tree. There he heard a voice calling from the ground, "Let me out, let me out." He dug down among the roots of the tree and found a well-sealed glass bottle from which clearly the voice had come. He opened it, and instantly a spirit rushed out and soon became half as high as the tree. Well, the story goes, I need to read you a little more because it actually identifies itself. The spirit cried in an awful voice, "I have had my punishment, and I will be revenged. I am the great and mighty spirit Mercurius, and now you shall have your reward. Whoso releases me, him I must strangle." Well, in the fairy tale, for the sake of time, the boy tricks the Mercurius back in the bow, pops it up, and then says, "I'll let you out, but you got to, you can't kill me if I let you out. It's a deal." Mercurius says, "It's a deal." And the boy says, what do you give me if I do let you out? And Mercurius says, "Well, a bunch of stuff, but basically whatever this cloth I give you touches will turn to silver." So the boy touches his axe with it. It turns to silver. He sells it and finishes his school. What do you know about Mercurius?
Tricky.
And what else? What's the big thing about Mercurius?
Why? Michael,
yeah, he's a guide. So Mercurius would be the guiding aspect of the psyche, which we have all along been saying Sophia communicates. So that's the relationship between Mercurius and Sophia.
Communicates,
yeah.
This passage that you're reading here, we were suggesting that Sophia had masculine aspects, that would be Mercurius.
That's Mercurius. And this
aspect of her character?
Well, it would be, again, the masculine aspect of Sophia would simply be the guiding aspect of the Sophia experience. It's an aspect of her, or a quality of this experience, that it guides you. And you see that so clearly here in the dream, the fact that an element identifies himself as Mercurius. Now, that is an example of, I would say, of the self crystallizing out of an experience. See, it's embedded in the tree, and then it's pulled out of the tree. And I'll read you what Jung says about that. But apply it to the dream. Does this give you any clues about what that dream means? What's in the dream? What is the parallel image to Mercurius?
What's a tree?
Baby. Yeah.
Baby would be the fruit, though, of the experience.
That's what Mercurius is. Mm-hmm. You see my logic here?
Okay.
I'm trying to now take this, all the stuff we've done, and apply it to a particular case, how you would work with it, how you would see it.
Well, the one would be the death. I mean, you know, when he puts him back in the bottle would be death, and then the release would be rebirth.
No. Well, the way Jung works with it is that it's interesting what we're sort of getting into that now in this next chapter. These experiences come out, and they try to kill you. And you have to be able to contain them and say, you know, if you're going to give me bad dreams unconscious, I'm not listening. And fight back, because, and this is what is so unique about the Sophia experience, and in a sense, Mercurius being the same. The guidance just doesn't come to you like we're told Christ comes to save you. Mm-hmm. The guidance comes in a form which tries to destroy you. And you have got to know that you are in danger of being destroyed and resist that destruction. Mm-hmm. And as you resist that destruction and work with it, and that working with it then is the theme of this next chapter, the meaning becomes clear. Mm-hmm. In the text we just worked with, the candle being basically removed to hell, or we have to restore it, that would be in the fairy tale, the fact that Mercurius was buried in the roots of the tree.
Okay. So would that be kind of where Jung was talking to Johnson about that you must give it form or it will just, or it will destroy you, the dream?
That would be one way, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the whole purpose of the mandala too? I mean, giving that form?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, what's the dream mean?
With the baby in the tree?
Mm-hmm. What's happening to the dreamer?
There's new life, a new attitude being born.
What new attitude?
What new attitude?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's in the tree, I would say it's Sophia, feminine somewhere, that
mm-hmm.
tree of life.
But there is the dream is announcing a specific behavior change on the part of the dreamer. What is that specific behavior change? In other words, what specifically happens to people who have a Sophia experience? Now, the dreamer was not going through hell, but was going through a difficult time. Lost, disoriented, depressed. Not grossly depressed, but a little depressed. Confused. Sort of things have gotten boring.
Was there a rebirth, but it's fragile?
Yeah, but what's this rebirth?
Well, the rebirth
behavior.
Higher level of consciousness.
Behaviorally, how does that look? What's going to happen?
You mean not depending on the ego?
Hmm.
Yeah, not depending on the ego. Keep going.
Or having an orientation to the self.
Right. See, the dreamer up to now has arranged life by joining committees, participating in organizations, responsibly. Participating in social life. And for the first time, the dreamer is going to be coming to a position where not outer facts help the dreamer orient life, but a relationship to the inner voice is actually now being felt, and the dreamer will begin rearranging life based on the inner guidance, not just the outer demands. So it's the birth of a fundamental shift in attitude where the dreamer says, you know, I am not going to take part in any more of these external responsibilities. I'm going to let my inner voice show me what to commit myself to. And it may very well lead the dreamer back to social work, but it would be based on the inner voice. So the crystallization is we work for about 2 years now, and slowly you see a new attitude just coming up. A new feeling, this is how I'm going to live my life. And a slow withdrawal of activity in the old forms, literally resigning from previous responsibilities, and hearing where life is going to go. And that's what I would say the text is like crystallizing out. A new attitude just emerges.
when it comes out of the water, like a, you know, the baby coming out of the water through a feminine hand, would that be like something to do with the emotions, the new attitude?
Yeah.
Emotions?
Now, I would say this because you see, you know, compare the fairy tale and the dream, and I'll take a break here, and I'll just read you very briefly what Jung says about it because it's very close to Sophia. The fairy tale is much more of a Sophia experience because the spirit is in the ground, it's in the body, in the earth, and we've talked about Sophia as starting with desire, basically desire, disease, aggression, or depression. Now, the dreamer was a little depressed, which is why I feel I can call this a Sophia experience. Something came out of accepting the darkness. But not totally, purely Sophia, because the baby in the dream was not in the ground, it was in the branches of the tree. So that, to me, would mean that this is not an experience coming to her through flesh, but coming simply out of consciousness, or simply out of the dreams. Yeah, that's the difference. With somebody who would be suffering with a desirous situation, somebody who would be wrestling with resentment, somebody who was recovering from an illness, you'd be much more likely to see that baby come out of the earth. But this dreamer was not, and so the child isn't in the earth. Well, let's take a break, and I'll come back, and I'll just read you a little bit what Jung says, hopefully giving you another example of what the Sophia thing looks like in people's lives, and how we work with it.
I just take over. I just come up.
I don't care.
Sophia.
Don't you think?
I think so. Inspiration.